Welcome to Power Play for Friday, May the 4th. Let's tackle the top political headlines of the day. We'll be starting with the government's marijuana woes in just a few moments. But first, here's what else you'll see on today's show. Pipeline politics heat up. The federal government pronouncing that they're going to get involved in Trans Mountain. Their domain, they say, but the BC government begs to differ. British Columbia's Attorney General is on the show to join us for this federal showdown in court. And the Conservatives prepare to paint Alberta Tory blue again. The United Conservative Party holds its very first convention. We'll find out if they have what it takes to win the upcoming election. And we're also headed down to Washington, D.C. for the latest on President Donald Trump's speech to the NRA just weeks after he vowed to crack down on gun control. Will he keep his promise? Well, first, after sitting back and watching the pipeline drama unfold in BC as the provincial government filed a reference with BC's highest court asking if the provincial government can turn off the taps on that black gold from Alberta. Now the federal government says they're going to intervene in the case. Here is the reaction of BC's Attorney General. He's here with us to provide us with their thoughts of the BC government. He is, of course, David Eby. Mr. Eby, thank you for joining us all the way from Vancouver today. Your thoughts when you found out that the federal government was going to seek intervener status?
Well, my initial reaction on hearing the federal government's plan to intervene was one of frustration. We've been asking the federal government for a number of months now to join us in a joint reference on this. The highest court level that we can go to is the BC Court of Appeal under our legislation that allows us to refer questions like this. That means that there's a level above it, of course, the Supreme Court of Canada. The federal government, on the other hand, we could go directly to the Supreme Court of Canada if they were partners with us on the reference or if they joined us in bringing the reference forward. Instead, now they've come to the BC Court of Appeal to argue it with us, which leaves another level yet. And we keep hearing how urgent it is to resolve this, how quickly they need an answer. And we agree. We think that we should be getting an answer on this as quickly as possible. But I cannot understand why they're coming to the BC Court of Appeal instead of everybody going to the Supreme Court of Canada.
I'm curious about that. Do you think that maybe they're not as serious about the pipeline as they imply they are?
I can't speculate about the motives of the federal government or the decision-making process that has led them to come to a lower court level on the reference instead of taking us up on the offer to do a joint reference and to get it to the highest level of court in Canada. But what I can say is what we keep hearing is that there's a need for finality, there's a need for certainty, and there is some urgency around clarifying jurisdiction. And just for those people who are watching who may not have the background on this, this is around British Columbia's right to regulate substances in the province, including heavy oil, regardless of how it comes in, whether it's by rail or by pipeline, in order to ensure that there's adequate spill response capacity, that we're able to clean it up when and if there is a spill that happens with heavy oil. And we are attempting to legislate within the final inch of our constitutional jurisdiction to do so. There's been a challenge of our ability to do that by the federal government, by the government of Alberta. So we said we'll refer it to the courts. We'll get a decision from the courts. The highest level we can go to is the Court of Appeal. We tried to go to the federal government and say, let's go together to the Supreme Court of Canada. Let's do a joint reference and get this resolved finally. But we can't, which means that we'll get a decision from the BC Court of Appeal. And then almost certainly, it's hard to imagine a scenario where this isn't appealed by one of the involved parties to the Supreme Court of Canada, which adds an extended amount of time and delays a final decision that much longer. So I can't understand why they're taking this approach.
Did they give you any sort of a reason as to why they didn't want to go straight to the to the Supreme Court when you put that offer on the table?
The discussion certainly in the public was that the federal government was confident in their jurisdiction. They didn't believe there was any question that needed to be referred to the court. They didn't believe that there was any issue that needed to be resolved. Obviously, now they've looked at the reference. They've looked at where we're attempting to exercise our jurisdiction, where we believe our authority lies, which is to ensure adequate spill response to protect the tens of thousands of jobs that are dependent on our coastal economy here in British Columbia. They've had a look at it. They realize that there is, in fact, a serious question, as we've always been saying that there was. So now they're going to show up to the court at the Court of Appeal. But it really doesn't resolve, for me anyway, and I'm sure for many people who are saying we need a final decision, we need certainty around this, why we're not all in the Supreme Court of Canada instead of in the BC Court of Appeal.
I think that people at home are wondering, if you were to get a decision in your favor from the BC court and then eventually perhaps from the Supreme Court, would you actually stop these pipelines from being built or stop oil from rail from crossing? Because it will have tremendous economic consequences for other parts of Canada.
Yeah, and I think there's a real misunderstanding about what British Columbia's reference is about and what we're saying our authority is. So there's no question around the construction of the pipeline, around regulating the flow of the pipeline, around interprovincial matters, that this is a federal government jurisdiction. But we say that as long as we're not impairing that beyond a certain level, it's okay for the province to have standards in place around ensuring that the equipment's in place to clean up, ensuring that we have the knowledge and the scientific knowledge about how to clean this up, because there's literally $1 billion plus of economic activity, whether the seafood industry, tourism, or otherwise. When the federal government did the assessment process, we went to the federal court and we argued that the impact on British Columbia of this pipeline was not adequately considered. But regardless, that we have the ability to clean it up if there is a spill. And we say we're going to the court to ask this question. Do we have the jurisdiction or the authority to do that? We're asking the court to resolve it. And the reason why we're in court in the first place was that the federal government and the Alberta government said there is no way that you have authority to do this. We don't believe it. In fact, we're not even going to join you in a joint reference. We think there's so little credibility in what you're saying. And now, of course, the federal government is coming to the BC Court of Appeal to intervene because there is, in fact, a serious jurisdictional question here. There is a serious question for the court. There's draft legislation. And I'm glad they're there. I think it's important that they're there. The only question that I have is, why are we not going to that final level of court, to the Supreme Court of Canada? Because any number of interested parties are surely looking at intervening in this. That could be Kinder Morgan in relation to their pipeline project. It could be the railway companies in relation to their shipments of heavy oil in British Columbia. And everybody, including the province of BC, wants finality and certainty on this. We're going to the highest court that we can. We would like to go to the Supreme Court of Canada, but the feds are the only ones with the keys to that door.
Okay, well, certainly an interesting question and an interesting change in tune from the federal government. Thank you so much for joining us today, Mr. Eby.
Thanks for having me.
We are going to have to outlaw immediately all vans and all trucks, which are now the new form of death for the maniac terrorists.
Well, that was President Donald Trump speaking to the NRA earlier today. Here to make sense of his speech and all that he had to say in the much-anticipated address from George Washington University is Lara Brown. She joins me now from Washington. Thanks for joining us, Lara. You had a chance to listen to the speech. What was your takeaway on what the president had to say to the National Rifle Association?
Well, I think the most important takeaway is that he's ready for the 2018 elections. He's very interested in making sure that NRA supporters and those people who supported him in the 2016 presidential election are enthusiastic and excited about the 2018 midterms and that they turn out in support of Republican candidates across the country.
Now, there was all of this discussion that he was going to be more pro-gun control after there was multiple mass shootings, as there have been for many years in the United States, including, again, in a high school. And those students campaigned so clearly and so strongly. He said, look, yes, it's time to do more on gun control. Did you get a sense that the president is going to follow through on that promise based on what he said to the NRA today?
No, absolutely not. He really spent time focusing on the idea that had individuals had guns in France, then the attack in Paris would have ended differently. He talked about arming teachers in schools with guns. And so his focus is much more on, as he sort of described, protecting those Second Amendment rights and ensuring that gun owners are able to own and possess and use their guns. So I don't think that we will see him talking anytime soon about everything from the bump stocks issue to whether or not it's worth it to raise the minimum age for assault rifles.
Why is it, Canadians always wonder this, why is it so hard to make these kinds of changes in the United States? Why is the NRA so powerful?
Well, they're powerful because they've done a really good job of organizing at the grassroots level. And one of the realities of the United States is that much of the country is rural or semi-rural, meaning that it's close enough to rural areas and woodlands that people really do have an affinity for hunting and other sorts of sports involving rifles and guns. And so what you have is a very large expanse of the country that spends a lot of time engaged with rifles and guns. And I think when you look at how the NRA is organized at that local level in the communities, they work to sort of increase their individual memberships in every county and state. And that is what makes them powerful at the state level. And then as a result, powerful at the federal level.
Well, we're almost at the end of our time, but I do want to touch on the topic that people are always talking about, Stormy Daniels. Donald Trump initially said, of course, that the payment wasn't from him. Rudy Giuliani gives all of these interviews. He completely contradicts the president. The president has now had to clarify his statement. What does this tell you about the state of the White House and the kind of communication that's going on inside this administration?
Well, it tells us what we've known for quite some time, which is that Donald Trump is really the only one who knows the truth, and he consistently offers different versions of his truth. And so most people in and around the White House are left wondering what they should say or how they should say it. We saw this yesterday with Sarah Huckabee Sanders in the White House press briefing. We saw it with Giuliani last night, him believing that he was delivering the president's message, and then him today having to walk back his initial claims. So most people in and around this president are uncertain about where the truth really lies and what should be said about what has been done.
Well, an unprecedented administration. Thank you so much for your time today, Lara.
Thanks for having me on.
Stay with us. Power Play returns right after this short break with the government's point man on pot. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is doubling down on the government's timeline for pot legalization, despite calls from the Senate for a year-long delay. So why are the Liberals sticking to their guns in the face of so much criticism? Well, Bill Blair is the government's point man on pot as the Parliamentary Secretary for Justice and Health. He joins us now from downtown Toronto. Mr. Blair, you have Indigenous groups calling for a delay, saying they've not been adequately consulted. You have provinces saying they're concerned about this. The Senate comes out and says, look, nobody is really ready. You're a former police officer. Certainly we have heard from a number of police organizations and police forces saying they're not ready for this. Why is your government so intent on sticking to that original timeline?
Well, let's be clear, Mercedes, we've been working on this with provinces, territories, engaging with First Nations and Indigenous communities and working very closely with law enforcement across this country for nearly 2.5 years. And there's been a great deal of work accomplished. And we're confident as we move forward that we can effect an orderly implementation of this legislation upon royal assent. And so we've made commitments based on, frankly, a clear understanding that the current system is failing our kids and failing our communities. You know, we have the highest rates of cannabis use, and the cannabis use of our kids, they're getting completely from 100% from organized crime, who's making billions of dollars in profit from this. And we believe that we have a responsibility to act expeditiously to address that concern. And the only means of controlling that activity now for all Canadians is with a criminal penalty. And we believe we can affect a far more just, healthy, and safe regime through comprehensive regulations. And so we are prepared to move ahead. We very much respect the important work that the Senate is doing. We will look forward to reviewing the results of their deliberations and their vote on June 7th. We're working with the provinces and territories who have told us after royal assent they need 8 to 12 weeks. We went and spoke to them all and said, what do you need for an orderly implementation? They said 8 to 12 weeks after implementation. And we said, we'll provide that time. And so we have been working with everyone and attempting to address their concerns.
Okay, so for people at home who are hearing you say that 8 to 12 weeks after royal assent, what is a realistic date at this point that Canadians can believe they will be able to purchase marijuana legally?
Well, I remain confident that Parliament can complete the important work that it has yet to do by the end of June. That's when we rise for the summer break. The Senate is having their vote on June 7th, and as a result of whatever may take place there, and I won't speculate, we hope that we can have this done by the end of June and achieve royal assent. We're then working with the provinces and territories. There's all sorts of things that need to be put in place that cannot move forward until that royal assent is given. And so a date of implementation will be established, 8 to 12 weeks after that royal assent, whatever date that might be. And so sometime between perhaps the middle of August until the middle of September will be the date that's determined. But that will be predicated on the results of Parliament's work and that royal assent, working very closely with the provinces and territories. We're giving them the time they said they needed to get this done.
Do you think in retrospect that you rushed legalization and maybe you should have worried about decriminalization first and then taken some time for legalization where people weren't facing criminal record consequences for using marijuana in the meantime?
Mercedes, it's a very important question. And let me be really clear, because a lot of people misunderstand what decriminalization means. Decriminalization retains the prohibition. You cannot regulate a prohibited substance. So if all we did was decriminalize, we would have left the entire production and distribution of cannabis in the hands of organized crime. Quite frankly, I am not prepared to leave the health and safety of our children and the health of all Canadians in the hands of criminals. And so it's only by lifting that prohibition that we have the opportunity to implement a very comprehensive system of regulatory control on its production, its distribution, and its consumption. None of that is possible if you maintain the prohibition.
But it would have given you more time to figure that out where you weren't criminalizing people.
Well, we've been working hard on this for 2.5 years. We sent a task force out that canvassed extensively for the best advice and looking at all of the evidence and made a number of recommendations to our government. We acted on that advice and on that evidence, and we brought forward a new regulatory package. We also began from day one working with the provinces, territories, with municipalities, and with First Nations. We very much respect and acknowledge the jurisdiction of the provinces, territories, municipalities, and of First Nations, and that's why we've been working with them. And that work will continue. We believe that we are in a very strong position to begin a process of orderly implementation. But, important to think of that as a process.
How's this going to work with First Nations? Because they're saying they don't feel they've been adequately consulted. There are far more of them than there are provinces. And I'm wondering, how does this work? Does each First Nation determine their taxation, determine how it's distributed? How involved and responsible is the federal government there?
Well, let me be clear. Each of us, the federal government, provinces, territories, and First Nations, have their jurisdictions. And it's important to respect and acknowledge that. The responsibility of the federal government is for the existing Controlled Drugs and Substances Act, and we propose to repeal the provision which makes a criminal offense of possession of cannabis and replace it with several hundred pages of very comprehensive regulation. We know that there's also a jurisdiction for provinces, territories to enact their legislation, and they've all brought forward their legislative frameworks. The cities also have, as well as First Nations, important jurisdictional responsibilities, and we're working with all of them to make sure that they're able to do what is required of them, and we'll continue that work beyond the date of implementation.
Well, we are out of time, but thank you very much for joining us today, Mr. Blair, with that update.
Thank you, Mercedes.
Up after the break, our weekending strategist panel is here to weigh in on the day's top political stories. Please stay with us. Welcome back to Power Play. Time for our week-ending strategy session. In Regina, we have Sally Hauser, a senior consultant with Navigator, and together in our downtown Toronto studio, but seated separately, we have Randy Rahimi, who is also with Navigator, and political commentator Jerry Nichols. Let's start with these NAFTA emails. This came out because there's been all this coverage of NAFTA, of course. You have Chrystia Freeland, the Foreign Affairs Minister, flying down there on Monday. It's going to be both a political and bureaucratic level negotiation. And now we find out that the government was really trying to connect across Canada at different levels of government to make sure everyone was on message. Jerry, I don't know if that's particularly surprising on something this big. Is that a good strategy?
Well, you know, one of my mantras is always to stress the importance of message discipline. Message discipline is extremely important, of course. But usually that's for a candidate or for a political party or for a government. This is the first time I've heard of an entire country being under the sort of the auspices of message discipline. And I guess that just reflects how important the NAFTA negotiations are to the Liberal government. They don't want anybody sort of straying off the reservation and saying something stupid about, say, Donald Trump. And you think, well, maybe the premiers are smart enough to know that anyway. But if you look at what Ontario Premier Kathleen Wynne is doing, and she's attacking Trump on a daily basis, maybe those talking points were a good idea.
Randy, what do you think? Do the provinces need these kinds of talking points, or is it fairly obvious to most of them that they would want to keep NAFTA in place?
I think kudos to the government, quite honestly. What they're doing is effectively running a campaign. I mean, this is how we treat most communications objectives. I actually disagree with Jerry. It's not just for political campaigns. In the private sector, when you're trying to influence a particular audience, you need to use message discipline. You need to get everybody singing from the same songbook. So I think politically, it demonstrates two things. One is, as Jerry said, just how important this is to the Trudeau government. The other is, who's on the other side? It's very much a statement about how concerned they are and how much they recognize that they're not dealing with just another government. They're dealing with President Trump, and that changes the rules of the game.
Sally, it's certainly high stakes. It's certainly unpredictable. But on something as major as NAFTA, should the federal government be dictating to the provinces and others what their interests are?
I will agree with both my friends here on the panel that, you know, having a message discipline is not unusual and sending that out. What I find interesting of it is that the messages seem pretty basic, frankly. Mm-hmm. You know, we're looking forward to sitting down at the table with the United States and Mexico. What it shows to me is that there wasn't some kind of real grand plan as they were going into it. I mean, I've worked in communications for a provincial government before. If I'd gotten that type of pretty base level messaging in my inbox from the federal government saying this is how you have to behave, I'd be a little bit insulted. So it's not that you were trying to have some kind of homogeneous message across the country, is that it was pretty simplistic in the way it was executed.
But isn't it also more a statement about what they're not supposed to talk about? I think that's reflective of don't get into the weeds, don't start talking specifics on NAFTA changes, stick to process. Stick to the easy message, because that's all we're at liberty to do right now.
Everyone sing from the same songbook. Well, speaking of not the same songbook and many different, sometimes off-tune songs being sung, climate costs, Bill Morneau, the finance minister, coming out and saying that they will have a better sense of the costing of this carbon tax, which the Conservatives and the NDP as well have been saying, look, what are we looking at in terms of costs? How is this all going to play out? What does it look like for the economy? That now not going to be out until the fall. That's because Morneau is saying they have to wait for the provinces to get their act together on this. When you take a look at this, Sally, I know the NDP is in favor of it, but it still seems like an awfully long time to wait for a potentially very expensive, very costly, very important strategy that the federal government is imposing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's a level of danger in this circumstance of talking about, well, we need to wait for the provinces, because, of course, there isn't, an agreement necessarily across the country in terms of provincial acceptance of this. You have Scott Moe, where I am here in Saskatchewan, saying that he's going to be challenging and fighting the federal government on this similar messaging from Brian Palliser in Manitoba. So I think this kind of game of chicken that's being played at the federal level of, well, we can't get these rather ephemeral costs to you because we're still waiting on the provinces. In one way, I guess they're saying, okay, well, you know, these are the guys holding it up. But I also think it could probably add a lot of fuel to the fire from the provincial level.
Jerry, is this kind of a neat little way to try to wash your hands? It's the federal government's idea, but they're saying, well, now, the cost, that's not actually going to be up to us. That's going to be up to the provinces because it's going to be different in each province.
Well, I think the basic communication strategy from the Liberals from the beginning has been not to talk about the cost of the carbon tax, to kind of kick that down the road. This is a government, when it talks about its environmental agenda, likes to focus not on the cost, but on the benefits of the tax. And this makes it easier to sell from a PR point of view if you're only talking about the good things. So all you have to do is have the environment minister show up in the House of Commons dressed up in a climate crusader costume. And yeah, it's fun. But sooner or later, you know, the costs, whether the government wants to talk about it or not, are going to come out. When somebody fills up their gasoline and fear and experiences economic pain from how much it costs to buy the gasoline, the Liberals are going to have a problem. So sooner or later, they're going to have to address this tax and the cost of this tax, and they're going to have to do some propaganda to sell this tax.
Randy, I don't know about the strategy here. I mean, I understand the thought of pushing back the cost and pushing it back because it could be quite high. But on the other hand, every time you push it back, once you're past the halfway point in your mandate, you're closer to an election.
Closer to an election, and you're allowing someone else to actually set the narrative. So the danger, I think, for the Liberals right now is to continue to not talk about the costs. I think it behooves the Liberals to come out and say, you know what, we really believe in this tax, and here's why, and here's how much it's going to cost, but we think that's a worthwhile expenditure, and the cost of doing nothing is actually, or doing nothing is actually much more costly. And I think that that's a better communication strategy, and you're right. Getting out before the House rises end of June would be a smart time to do it, because then you allow the buffer of the summer to sort of wash it away a little bit. And I think that, you know, I understand where the Liberals have come to so far. The opposition is not letting up, and I think it's time to start messaging the cost is valuable, not just messaging the merits of the tax.
Okay, we have just a few minutes left, so I'm going to do a quick round robin on this, but take a look at the latest poll numbers. The Trudeau Liberals not looking trollish in these. They're rebounding from India and that disastrous trip. Took a look. You see the support there, an increase for the Liberals. They are surging back up. It's not huge, but it's certainly better than it was. Jerry, did the Conservatives lose their momentum?
Well, I don't think the Conservatives can look at it that way. I mean, I think the lesson they should take from this is not that he's rebounding in the polls right now, but what hurt him in the first place. And apparently what hurt him was his India trip. In other words, it wasn't some kind of scandal. It wasn't some kind of economic downturn. The prime minister just looks silly. So I think what that tells me is that even though the default position of Canadians is they like Trudeau, which is why he's rebounding right now, that support is soft. In other words, Trudeau is not invincible. He's vulnerable. So it's just a matter of whether or not the Conservatives and the NDP, for that matter, can figure out a way to exploit that vulnerability.
Sally, what's your take on these new numbers?
Well, I imagine that there's a significant sigh of relief happening in Ottawa at the government level. This is frankly a positive for them heading into the summer with strong numbers. Governments always take a bit of hit when you're in session and the opposition can hammer you every day. What it says to me is, frankly, the NDP and the Conservatives have not done a good enough job in the last little while in the House of really holding them to account, holding their feet to the fire, and they better figure out a way in the summer to get in the news and take a few hits on the Liberals.
Randy, you know, when you talk to Liberals about this, they say, oh, well, this too will pass. It's passing, but is it sort of that initial thread that pulls from the sweater and then can continue to be pulled as it unravels? The opposition now has more traction than before.
I don't think it's just due to the Liberals' ineffectiveness that the opposition's ineffectiveness that the Liberals are doing better. I actually think some kudos need to go to the Liberal Party. Quite honestly, they recognize that personal brand, they had relied maybe too heavily on personal brand of Trudeau to lift the party. They've pretty much gone to ground with him. I don't think he's been as provocative, as out there as he was prior to the India trip, and that's worked for them. So, you know, personal brand and how it impacts the federal election will be important to watch going forward. I think this has been a demonstration that they can't rely too heavily on Trudeau's brand leading into next year.
Interesting stuff. Well, thank you very much to our Friday strategists. We'll see you all next Friday. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
See you.
Coming up, Alberta's United Conservative Party gathers for the first time. Alberta Alberta's United Conservative Party holds its first convention this weekend, a critical time for the newly formed party as they vote on policies that will help define them in the coming election. Joining me now on this topic from Calgary is Alberta political commentator Dwayne Bratt. You know, a lot of people are saying this is where we're going to get a sense of what this party stands for. But how much of what they're going to head into the election with really comes from this kind of a convention versus from Jason Kenney?
Oh, I think it's really about Jason Kenney. He is basically the architect of the party. Over Stampede in 2016, he gave this audacious speech and outlined this five-point plan of how he was going to defeat the NDP government by winning the leadership of the Progressive Conservative Party, merging them with the Wild Rose Party, getting that merger ratified by the grassroots, winning the new party's leadership, and defeating the NDP. He's done every step but the last one, but they are poised to do so.
Dwayne, a lot of people in Ottawa will say, well, I don't know, can Jason Kenney really do it? You're in Alberta. You have your finger on the pulse. Has he successfully united the right? And is there a desire, do you think, to change governments?
Oh, there is absolutely a desire. I was involved in a very deep series of polls and focus groups that went on for 16-minute type questions, 90-minute focus groups. Kenny, as a party, not only do they lead by 20 points, but on every major issue, they have a 20 to 30 point lead over the NDP. If this election, as I think it will be, is fought on the economic situation and on pipelines, Jason Kenney will be the next premier of Alberta. And on that pipeline issue, one of the most startling things that emerged out of the focus groups was even if construction begins while Notley is premier, Kenney will get credit for it because it was Kenney, people believe, who pushed Notley to go places that she didn't want to go, such as introducing legislation restricting the export of oil to BC.
Well, it really seems like he has pushed Notley to the right. I'm curious, behind the scenes with his own party, it seems like there's been a pretty smooth transition there. There was a strong movement to stop him, and then it's like he overcame some kind of hurdle, came over the top, and now, from what we're seeing here, it certainly looks very calm and like he's managed to take power quite effectively.
Oh, absolutely. There are some potential landmines of this policy convention. The media and especially the opposition is going to look for any turmoil around social issues. Because under the old Wild Rose Party, there used to be these frequent flare-ups about abortion, about same-sex marriage. And there's been some of that with the UCP caucus. Now, the question is this going to occur on the weekend, or is Kenney going to really be able to stage manage this and keep the focus on the economy? Part of the reason they need the convention is we have a good sense of what they are opposed to, and we have a good understanding of what their oil and gas policy is, but we don't really know what their healthcare policy is or what their education policy is. And those are the major instruments of a provincial government. Those need to be fleshed out this weekend.
How does Kenney handle it if you have these social issues popping up? He himself is a social conservative. That's not a secret. He's a devout Catholic. How is he going to deal with things like the abortion issue?
My guess is he's going to do it very much the way Stephen Harper used to do it and just put it in a box and hide it under the table and say, we're not going to discuss anything. You know, we are going to be focused on pipelines. We are going to be focused on repealing the carbon tax. We are going to be focusing on balancing the budget. Everything else is a distraction. But here's the contrast. The UCP is supposed to be a grassroots-led party. What happens if some of those grassroots members want to discuss these issues as opposed to what Jason Kenney wants, which is a convention with no controversy? So there you have the clash. My guess is Kenney will become victorious within his own party on this.
We'll keep a close eye on it. Fascinating. Thank you so much for joining us from out west today, Dwayne.
You're welcome, Mercedes.
When we return, our Friday Press Gallery is here with their picks for the political plays and misplays of the week. Stay with us. back, let's bring in our Friday Press Gallery for their takes on the political plays and misplays of the week. They're already having fun, I can tell you that. Joyce Napier is CTV's Ottawa Bureau Chief. Evan Solomon is the host of CTV's Question Period. And joining us from our Toronto studio, CTV's special correspondent, Lloyd Robertson. Lloyd, start us off today. I understand you have a misplay for us.
Yes, I think this was a misplay. The Prime Minister doubling down on the pot legislation after giving some indication earlier in the week after that Senate report came out saying delay this whole thing for a year, that no, this legislation is going to be rammed through somehow this summer and fall. And it's got more holes than Swiss cheese. I mean, even though your argument from Bill Blair was quite smooth and even persuasive maybe to some people, but look what they're dealing with. The natives, first off, you know, the idea of the education, the profit sharing, the taxation, addiction treatment issues that they're bringing forward. And then there's the whole real estate thing, the Canadian Real Estate Board coming out and talking on behalf of some of the provinces saying, look, you know, are we going to be able to sell homes to people who want to move into a house where they've been growing pot? That's an issue. And Manitoba and Quebec have already said they will not go for this idea of a maximum of four pots being presented, being grown in houses and households. So you're going to have this patchwork of pot chimneys across the country, some in one area and none in others. And then, of course, there are the other issues like the border, all of these things. And the politics are pretty clear. I mean, the Prime Minister wants this out of the way before they get into the next election campaign so that he doesn't go into the October 19th election having to say that, you know, facing the opposition questions about breaking another promise that he stood by, that pot would be legalized in this country this year.
Joyce, we had Bill Blair on the show today, and he said, oh, well, it'll be 8 to 12 weeks after royal assent. The deadline keeps moving, because now we're looking at least the end of August, if it happens in July, maybe September. And the government insists that they don't think they rushed it.
Well, and I'll add to the list that Lloyd just provided us with the policing issues, which are huge, and probably the constitutional challenges that will come of that, because how are you going to detect a DUI, a driving under the influence of marijuana? We know that we don't have the science for that yet. In Canada, they're still debating what machines and what methods we're going to use. So there's so many issues on so many different levels that one wonders why don't you just wait till the spring? But then that bumps into the federal election, and perhaps they don't want to be dealing with a botched sort of promise and while they're trying to run a campaign.
Evan, have they botched this?
Look, pot and politics don't necessarily go together here. There's a lot of reasons to delay it, and Joyce and Lloyd outlined it. You know, police are concerned about it. The real estate people are concerned about it. First Nations, Indigenous communities. There's lots of reasons, Mercedes, but the number one thing for the Liberals, and we've always known this, after September, it's got to go, because there's going to be a ton of screw-ups. There's going to be busts on dispensaries. There's going to be jurisdictional issues on reserves. There's going to be a ton of issues. They've got to get all those bugs sorted out, all the bad trips, before this becomes an election issue. And the Conservatives are going to do everything they can to drag it out and be a buzzkill. It is going to be legal on September, and because politics trumps pragmatism on this 100%.
I want more puns by that time,
Evan. I can do puns all day.
But in the meantime, Joyce, you also have a misplay for us this week.
Yes, I have a misplay. You know, this whole NDP party kicking out this MP, Aaron Weir, over allegations that are very vague. He's awkward, and there were complaints, but they actually shopped for the complaints. It just looks like, you know, the hashtag Me Too, which you know, to many women is, you know, kind of a liberating thing, that you can finally come out and say and tell the truth and say if you're harassed. It's sort of a misuse of that. A misuse of what is out there now, what is available out there for women. And they ganged up on this guy, and we still don't know why he was kicked out of caucus. He doesn't know why he was kicked out of caucus. So perhaps they were a little fast on the trigger. I think perhaps the NDP should have given it more thought.
Evan, you're handling?
Look, it was handled sort of oddly at first, right? All of a sudden, there was a third-hand allegation about something, an anonymous allegation, and Jagmeet Singh immediately suspended him and called this two-month independent investigation. So already, Aaron Weir was in the hot seat already. And he told me he was worried that this would become a fishing expedition. We invite anyone to come forward. 2 months later, the investigator comes forward, and there's four counts of harassment, some of them sexual harassment. They were of the type that they were nonverbal cues he wasn't reading, and he admits he doesn't read nonverbal cues. The party was ready to, what they use the word, rehabilitate and give him sensitivity training, which he said he would do. Then he came on this program, did an interview, and then it showed Jagmeet Singh that he was not accepting the results of the investigation, not a team player. The interesting thing is, despite the fact that the public says, does this rise to the level of losing your job? There's real questions. The NDP caucus supports the leader on this. He did not support Jagmeet Singh on a number of other issues when he tried to discipline other MPs. On this one, you speak to them and they say, he did the right thing. Aaron Weir wasn't playing ball. So inside the party, this is a win for Jagmeet Singh. For the rest of us, it's still, frankly, a little confusing.
Well, and Lloyd, you always have your finger on the pulse of Canadians. How is this playing outside of Ottawa?
Well, I heard Aaron Weir on Evan's show this week, often listen to his national radio broadcast, and he sounded like the aggrieved party in all of this. This looks bad for them all, from my point of view, both the NDP leadership and Aaron Weir. Nobody comes out of this one smelling like roses. But what it says to me, bottom line here, is that Jagmeet Singh has just got to get himself into the House of Commons, closer to that caucus. I mean, caucus schmoozing is a big deal with party leaders. Look at what Brian Mulroney did. Look at the way Jean Chrétien held things together during his time. That's what this is all about. And Jagmeet Singh has got to bite that bullet, run somewhere, and get in there if he possibly can, and soon.
Okay, Evan, we're going to end the week on a high. You have a play.
Yeah, if you look out the window, and I don't know if we can look out the window, you see the Ottawa River there right
it's
behind
rising.
Us. And a year ago today, we had huge floods here. The whole country is watching Gatineau and Ottawa and all up down the river. Thousands of people displaced from homes. It's going on right now in New Brunswick, and it's going on right now in B.C. And I spoke to the mayor of St. John, New Brunswick, Mayor Darling, and they're working hard to save their homes, to save a lot and their communities. And I guess my play is, in the midst of these disasters, the spirit of Canadians shows up, and we've seen it in a couple things after the horrible events in Toronto and then Humboldt, Broncos tragedy. But here again, we're seeing communities just come together. And I know we're supposed to talk about political plays here, but the political leaders in these situations really do a great job. They rally. You know, there's a moment where you need political leaders to cut the crap and the partisanship and actually get stuff done. And they're doing it. Guys like Mayor Darling in St. John, way to go, in St. John, New Brunswick. And we saw it here in Ottawa. We saw it in Quebec. We see it. And it's the best of Canadians and the best of our political leaders come together.
And you know what? We also saw that this week, sadly, very sadly, in the House of Commons, when Conservative MP Gord Brown passed suddenly in his office. And you really saw in the House of Commons one of those rare times when they actually come together. They were actual hugs in the House of Commons. You know, great tributes to the man. And you saw that when they come together, they actually warm the heart.
Lloyd?
Not when they fight, though.
Final word to you.
Well, it's great spirit. I mean, I was in a lineup at the LCBO this week, if I may say that, and they were asking for donations for Toronto Strong, $2, $5, or $10. And the two or three people ahead of me all donated, as I did. That is the spirit. It's grassroots, and it's a wonderful Canadian value to see.
Yeah, absolutely. Evan, you want to wrap it
up? Yeah, Lloyd, maybe by September you'll be in the lineup of the cannabis
Unemployment line, who knows?
Can I just say, in the spirit, and I know Lloyd would be here, he's the one delivering this, it is a special occasion in the CTV family today. It is Mercedes' birthday, and we want to wish you a happy birthday.
Happy birthday, Mercedes.
No. 29. Wow.
Let's just say, we're not even sure if she's old enough to avail herself of what will be legal.
Thank you, Allie.
And that's Allison,
our wonderful producer.
Happy birthday, Mercedes.
Thank you. That many candles. That's how old I am.
That's
too.
It.
Okay. Well, before we cut the cake and eat it, Evan, my birthday present will be what's on your show this week. Is it good?
Believe me, I hope you get a better birthday present. As good as CTV's question period is, I hope it's better. Now, we'll talk about a lot of these issues. Joyce and I will be there along with Craig Oliver, and it's going to be great. Some great topics, but we hope you have a great weekend, Mercedes.
Thank you very much. And thank you for the wonderful cake, which we will all dig into shortly. Yes. So I'm going to wrap the show up on that. That's your week in Canadian politics. We'd love to know what you think of the show. So please make sure to reach out to us through social media on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can also contact us via our email. Our email address is powerplay@ctvnews.ca. Molly Thomas is up next with the latest headlines. For the Power Play team, I'm Mercedes Stevenson. Don Martin will be back at this time on Monday right here on CTV News Channel. Have a great weekend.
Deliver that now to more.
Thank you. Yeah.